This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, November 14th, 2011. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ahead on today's edition of Ozarks, we begin a series on international students at the University of Arkansas. Today's story profiles a graduate student from India. Plus, we learn about the band Rayburn during the latest installment of Arkansongs. KUAF is supported by Greenhouse Grill, offering the Greenhouse Grill Thanksgiving Eve dinner on Wednesday, November 23rd from 5 to 10 p.m. Live music will be provided by Three Penny Acre, and this once-a-year menu can be found on the web at greenhousegrill.com. Limited reservations are available at 444-8909. Last Friday, many people throughout the region were focused on the long-awaited opening of Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville. However, there was another opening being celebrated in the River Valley. Bordertown Skate Shop and Skate Park, an indoor destination unique to the area, held its grand opening this weekend. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas attended the event and has this report.
When Andrew Clark picked up skateboarding, his father, Steve Clark, saw an opportunity to create jobs and to capitalize on the characteristics of the typical skater. He joined forces with the skateboarding community and opened Bordertown Skate Shop and Skate Park in Fort Smith.
I'm really tapped into kind of the entrepreneurialism culture that's occurring here in this part of the state, and my son Andy is an avid skater. And I started kind of just exploring kind of the genetics or the DNA of a typical skater. And it just occurred to me that, you know, while they're not anarchists, they're certainly comfortable with being outside everyday norm. In addition to that, they're fiercely competitive, they're risk takers, they're very creative, very bright. And it just kind of resonated with me that they were, you know, perfect material for business startups and entrepreneurialism.
In talking with a friend about his idea, he learned of a young skater with this entrepreneurial spirit.
Just kind of talking about a vision that I had for it, he said, well, you really need to meet Nick Gibson. So I did. I reached out to Nick, had him up, you know, for my house. You know, he gets out, I'm sure he was wondering what he was getting into. But a lot of shared passion, a lot of shared vision, and I think for him it was just, you know, kind of a dream come true.
Nick Gibson is now the manager of Bordertown. When he was approached by Steve about opening a skate shop, he immediately started thinking with a business mind.
I said the only way a skate shop would last here in this city would if you had an indoor park attached to it, because you need the skate park to build the scene and keep the skaters skateboarding, and then you need the skate shop right there on hand if kids break their boards or need a new board or anything like that.
They found Team Payne Skate Parks, a business out of Florida also ran by skaters. Team Payne built and designed the Fort Smith Park. They have also designed for the X Games, an annual sports competition controlled by ESPN. Steve speaks fondly of working with Team Payne, an experience he says has evolved into a friendship.
And I think, you know, the one word that's really important in this culture, in the skate culture, is legitimacy, and those guys are legitimate. You know, not all of them, but most of them have been sponsored skaters during their career. This is what they do. They build skate parks. And they were blown away. You know, they were blown away by the number of kids that were just waiting and watching. We would have 15, 20, 25 kids a day just watching them build the park. And I think they were just blown away, you know, by the interest that, you know, kind of the built-up or pent-up interest waiting for something like this to happen. So, in fact, they were with us about, I'm going to say, 3 weeks, and it was fantastic. I mean, they're friends now.
One of the kids watching the build was Nigel Pillard. He was there from the start of the build and even lent a helping hand.
It took a lot of work and effort into getting this thing done. Came here to sweat, help move stuff, build stuff, help bring stuff in, just everything. You know, this little stuff around the place.
The park itself is 11,000 square feet. The ramps are made out of birch rather than man-made masonite, a wood that Nick says will be very durable and require little maintenance.
On that surface material, the birch, after about 3 years, we'll have to flip it over and use the other side. That's the good thing about that, is both sides are the same material, so you can just flip it over and use the other material for another 3 years. So
the park has other unique design features. Mike Hawkins, a skater and friend of Bordertown, describes one as not really a bowl or a pool, but more of an arc.
It's an egg, and Jeff Hammond from Team Payne's been wanting to build this for years, but nobody's been willing to commit to it. And the guys at Bordertown decided that to go for it and have it built.
Mike was on hand for the entire build, filming the construction of the park to be included on the park's website and to be played in the skate shop. Mike filmed time-lapse footage.
I've recorded 24 hours of footage of the park build. What I did was I had a camera on a tripod that recorded 2 seconds every 30 seconds, and it recorded 4 minutes an hour, and you speed it up in editing, and it makes it the time go by faster. And I had another camera that I used as a portable for close-ups and skating that we were filming while the park was being built.
The film project taps into the aforementioned creativity of the skater.
Incorporated into Bordertown as part of a collaboration of creative arts blended with skateboarding.
This creativity is also exhibited on the walls of the park, where graffiti artists have left their mark. Steve says this is yet another way to reach out to the community.
We brought in some renowned artists from Dallas. And as soon as we started painting on the side of the wall, we had, you know, guys kind of coming out of the bushes going, hey, what's going on? It turns out there's some great local art talent. And so in addition to just the skate park, we're reaching out to local artists, you know, the young people. We're providing canvas for them to take home, put their art, come back, they can hang it in our shop. If it sells, they get 100% of the proceeds. But it's just really an avenue to reach out to all the kids. And we have football fields for football players, we have basketball courts for the basketball players, but we haven't really historically done much for the kids that maybe don't fall into those categories.
The community outreach doesn't stop there. Some of the kids have just returned from Houston, attending a charitable skateboarding event. Steve says that charity events are something that Bordertown will participate in.
I think it's imperative, frankly. I mean, I think what you'll find is this group of young people are very charitable, very giving, very loving. So anytime that we can reach out to our community in unexpected ways, utilizing unexpected demographic, I would imagine that most people would not anticipate, you know, their typical ideal of a skater being someone that really is concerned about charitable activities, but the fact is it's just the opposite. So the Johnny Romano Skate Jam in Houston was a fantastic opportunity for our kids to get to participate in a worthy charitable cause, and I think you'll find that Bordertown will be a leader in this community as it relates to charitable opportunities.
Nick Gibson, Bordertown manager, speaks of a program the skate park is participating in to promote volunteerism.
Right now we're working with the United Way, and we're getting where kids can go donate time with the United Way. Like 2 hours will get them one weekday session, and 3 hours will get them a weekend session. So when they go donate their time, they can come back and give us the sheet showing they donated that time, and we give them a free session. So that's for kids that don't have jobs or don't have parents that can afford to get them to come skate, stuff like that, you know, just to help them get off the streets and have some fun.
While getting kids off the streets, the skate shop and park are proving to be a learning experience for them. Lessons that Steve Clark says was one of his intentions.
Building it the way we did was the introduction of, you know, this crowd, this community, these young people, you know, what it means to run a business, what it takes to run a business. You know, Andrew, my son Andrew Clark, and his best friend Cole Rickard, you know, this is their initiative. So we're teaching inventory, we're teaching, you know, business relationship, basic accounting, kind of a disruptive education model. So you know the kids want to be here already because it's a great place. And so once they're here, what can we teach them, you know, and in what fashion can we teach them that engages them to be really motivated, you know, motivated in school, motivated in career, motivated in the arts.
Community outreach began this weekend at the park's grand opening. It was crowded with skaters, performing tricks, utilizing the ramps, excitement evident on their faces and in their movements. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net has started a new series called The CEOs. It takes a look at what would happen if two chief executives sat down and shared thoughts with each other on what's driving business decisions in their fields. Roby asked Delta Trust CEO French Hill to lead the new initiative. He and Baptist Health CEO Russ Harrington met recently to discuss the current business climate and healthcare insight.
The first thing that strikes me is there's no better mirror on our national economy and our local economy than Baptist Health for two reasons. One, the subject is healthcare, and two, you're the third largest private employer in the state.
Correct.
Which is exceptional. What's the mood in the executive suite at Baptist Health these days?
Uncertainty. You know, there are a lot of changes going on, French, nationally, but a lot of focus on healthcare reform. And that makes it difficult for us to plan and execute because of the uncertainty. You know, will the healthcare reform law survive the challenges in the Supreme Court? If not, what comes after that? The political scene, what's going to happen there? That will definitely impact it. So we're in a period of great uncertainty, makes it difficult to plan. However, you can't just do nothing. So we're continuing to focus on the things that we think we need to be focusing on, regardless of what healthcare reform turns out to be, what it looks like. And you just keep doing what you've always done, and you try to position your organization so that you can be flexible with whatever's thrown at you.
Well, clearly, regardless of healthcare reform, this idea of cost reduction and somehow coming up with a more homogeneous way to treat patients with a common diagnosis is a top element. It's in the Healthcare Reform Act, but it's been something that people have talked about for a long time. Is that an area that you guys are working on now at Baptist Health?
Certainly. I would tell you that most providers first are looking at their cost structure and what they can do about that. We've been focusing on that intently for the last couple of years and are making some real progress. We're also having to try to figure out how to integrate physicians into the process, how to come up with partnerships, because we're probably going to be paid together in the future through some sort of bundled payment. So you try to figure out how you can do more of that. We also have to focus on continuing to improve quality and patient safety. That's a big piece of healthcare reform in terms of what they're going to pay for, what the federal government's going to pay for. We're looking at things like continuing to expand our primary care network. We've got to have the physicians to be able to take care of all these additional people who supposedly will be added to the health insurance rolls, meaning our business may pick up. So there are just a number of things that you have to anticipate and try to be ready for, even though you're not sure what the legislation is going to require.
Well, in Arkansas, of course, we have a huge rural area, and you solve it and address it with some 175 points of contact around the state, which is remarkable. And yet there's some actions in Congress, I think, that are proposing to cut back some of these rural health delivery systems that actually tried a low-cost way to deliver that simple, basic primary care where we don't have density of physicians.
That's probably the worst place to cut.
And was that part of health reform, or is that an unrelated matter?
It's more related to the need for reducing the deficit.
Okay.
And the current program that the president has submitted to the Special Committee on Deficit Reduction.
Right.
There seems to be more emphasis on cutting at the rural hospital level and in the rural providers than just recent years. Because in recent years, about the only places who've gotten increased funding in healthcare have been rural areas. And now all of a sudden it seems like the emphasis has changed and the cuts are going to be in those areas as well. And that's not good for our state, and it's not good for the health care of our citizenry.
Right. I would say that would have major deleterious effects in the Midwest particularly. And And it's only through that networking that you can actually get those productivity gains where you get a physician handoff to a primary trauma-type center and main hospital in a larger metro area.
Correct. And with the financial pressures that come from those kind of cuts, I think we're going to see more and more pressure on small rural hospitals, and I think we're going to see closure of some of those hospitals. And that's going to put a lot of pressure on people who live out in those areas, and it's going to force more people into the larger facilities like ours and other tertiary
providers. At huge transportation costs and poor handoffs, you know, there's going to be poor handoffs in the process, and there's going to be unneeded trips. Do you see that hospital groups like Baptist Health will end up absorbing those hospitals, or do you mean the facility itself will be closed and the beds taken out of the system?
There'll be some closures. Now, you're going to continue to see consolidation where it makes sense,
right,
and where it can be done appropriately and financially viably, but not all of them can be absorbed and taken care of by larger facilities. Like, I mean, there's a financial limit on how many of those you can do. We have three very good rural hospitals today, and we work really hard and struggle at times to ensure that they remain financially viable. We've had opportunities to take several more, but when you look at them, sometimes it makes it, you can't figure out a way to make it work financially.
Right.
So we'll see some closures.
Well, you mentioned the Deficit Reduction Act, and you may be a great optimist, but to find the Committee of 12 can successfully come up with a bipartisan solution by mid-November seems a bit of a stretch. So are you fearful that the across-the-board cuts will take place? Of course, Medicaid is off limits for the moment,
right,
and so it's primarily a Medicare 2% cut, which does affect all of our adult hospitals in the state. What are your views there?
Well, first of all, in healthcare, you have to be an optimist. Secondly, as we analyze it, I think I'd rather have the 2% across the board cuts.
And just be, because you can then manage
exactly
that.
You know what they're going to be.
Right.
You can manage to it. Today, you know, we've already, under the healthcare reform law, hospital or providers are already scheduled for $155 billion in cuts over the 10 years. These recent recommendations that the president has made to that committee adds another $321 billion on top of the $155. I see no way that we can handle that. So a 2% cut across the board for healthcare providers would be much better than some of the recommendations we think will come out of that committee.
Have you got a plan in place if that's necessary?
We have anticipated the $155 billion cuts would mean that over a 10-year period, we'll lose $138 million. We're not sure how we could make that up. I can tell you we don't have a plan to make up the additional $321 billion that we would get our share of.
Right. Let's take a minute and talk about your views as a business person to barriers to employment. We've talked about healthcare reform is producing uncertainty, so it's real hard to judge,
right,
and then the burden of regulation. What other barriers do you see to greater employment in the country?
I think the biggest barrier is the uncertainty. You know, I would be highly reluctant today to go out and start a new service and hire the new people to provide that service. You know, we're trying to maintain the services that we have,
right,
keep the high-quality people in the jobs that we have, but we're also looking for ways to reduce the numbers, become more efficient. We're not looking to add people or add services, go out and build a new healthcare delivery facility. Just too much uncertainty to do that. That's in our business, and that's true, I think, in every business, especially out in the private sector. If they don't feel comfortable that they can recover the cost of doing the new service or the building or adding the people, why would they do that?
And you said you were an optimist to be in healthcare, and you've got a capital campaign on your calendar for the upcoming years, $110 million.
Must be optimistic for that.
Got to be optimistic. And is that here on campus at Baptist Health, the majority of those
funds? Yes, sir, just this facility. Our hospital here is we just had our 37th birthday. It needs some updating. We've never had all private rooms. We're now the only hospital in Little Rock that doesn't have all private rooms. That puts us at a competitive disadvantage. We're working on that, and we're making progress. We have many more private rooms today than we had 3 years ago. But we can't get all private rooms without this program that we've defined as our capital campaign. As you may remember, we purchased the Southwest Hospital a few years ago. That gives us the ability to move some services from this facility out there and then renovate. But first we have to do some renovation there. Then we move everything off one level of this facility. And with that and the refurbishing of those units, we will have enough space for all private rooms here. So that's a big piece of that project. The other large piece of it is a total renovation of all of our operating suites. When we opened 37 years ago, we had state-of-the-art facilities, great operating suites, large enough we thought would last forever. Today, some of our operating rooms are small enough that we can't get all the innovative equipment that we have in the rooms and give adequate space for the surgeons to utilize the equipment. So we have some internal space to make the expansion with the renovation that we have to do, and that's a big piece of that project. It's necessary just to be able to recruit qualified surgeons that are coming out of training programs today where they've had large rooms and all the equipment, and they expect that when they come to a private hospital like ours.
Delta Trust CEO French Hill recently spoke with Baptist Health CEO Russ Harrington as part of a new TalkBusiness.net series called The CEOs. Support for content from TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York, online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com. And Verizon, offering small business solutions, including high-speed mobile broadband, wireless email, global services, and push-to-talk. More information at a Verizon communication store or online at vzw.com/smallbusiness. It's Monday, November 14th, 2011. Joining me now is Becca Bacon-Martin, features editor from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And 10 children from Northwest Arkansas, actually from the River Valley, have the opportunity to be munchkins today.
That's right.
There's a touring production of The Wizard of Oz coming to Fort Smith for one show only tonight, and the Academy of Arts at UAFS selected 10 children in their theater program to be munchkins. They've been working for like 6 weeks on this, working from videos to learn their dances and learn the music. And then they won't perform as a group of 10. They'll be divided to work with the professional adults who also play munchkins in the show tonight. What great fun. Can you imagine working with a professional theater troupe at that age?
Yeah, I couldn't.
Wow.
And I mean, it's pretty impressive. It's such a great experience. I mean, obviously it would be a good resume builder, I suppose, later on. But right now, I just think it'd be really cool.
They're little kids, and I bet they said they were most excited about meeting Toto.
Oh.
That was their big thing. Showtime is 7:30 tonight at the Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center in Fort Smith, and tickets are $32 to $35. The show is sold out.
Oh, wow.
But they always have turn-in tickets at the last minute, season ticket holders who can't come. So they said, if you really want to go, show up at the box office at 6:30 and see what happens.
Okay.
There's also an architecture lecture tonight. This is part of the architecture program at the university in Fayetteville. And Peter Rich, who is a professor of architecture, in Johannesburg, South Africa, will speak at 6:30. It's in the Hembry Auditorium in the Agricultural Food and Life Sciences Building, room 107E. And it happens at 6:30, or 5:30 rather, I'm sorry, and it's free.
Excellent. Thank you, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is features editor for Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. An annual report from UAMS shows Arkansas is continuing to make progress fighting childhood obesity. The past year has seen more schools prohibit junk foods and a decline in school contracts with soft drink companies. Dr. Martha Phillips, who conducted the study, says parents need to get involved too.
Parents can help by being more physically active with their children, by encouraging their children to get out and play, to spend less time in front of the television, less time playing video games and computer games, and more time engaging in routine physical activity. We all have a part to play in combating childhood obesity.
This is the seventh report of its kind. The report is one of the requirements of Act 1220 of 2003, which also established local nutritional committees for each school system. America Recycles Day is tomorrow. In honor of the day, Maylin Rice, executive director of the Boston Mountain Solid Waste Management District, is encouraging local residents to make a recycling pledge.
In 2011, what the district is asking people is to take the recycling pledge that the Keep America Beautiful and America Recycles Day committee has come up with. And basically, they're asking people that you pledge to learn about recycling options in my community, and I will find out where the materials are collected for recycling in my community can go. And then to act to reduce my personal waste by recycling. Within the next month, I will start to recycle one new type of material. And it gives a list of materials there that some people don't know can be recycled.
You can bring your recyclables and make a pledge beginning at 8 a.m. tomorrow at Ozark Natural Foods during their R3 initiative event. Pledges can also be made at americarecycles.org. KUAF is supported by Northwest Arkansas Business Journal, featuring wealth management, brokers, and state employees, plus local business news in Northwest Arkansas. The current edition is available at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com to register for daily business e-news or for more information. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Every year, the University of Arkansas celebrates International Education Week in honor of students who travel thousands of miles to get an education in the United States. These students bring with them their different cultures and experiences and the hope to gain a great education and find new friends in an alien country. This week, we'll talk to students from all over the world and gain insight into their lives here. Today, Ozarks at Large's Ithi Agnihotri Madulkar speaks with a student from India who's been in the U.S. for about 22 years, but rarely has his disability stood in the way of his desire to get a good education, make new friends, or even fly a plane.
Hi, I'm Anmol Bhatia. I'm a graduate student in the Rehabilitation Counseling Program here at the University of Arkansas.
Anmol and I are sitting on a bench outside his classroom in the Graduate Education Building on the University of Arkansas campus. We have 10 minutes before his independent living class starts. He tells me he's lived in the United States since 1989, close to 22 years. He was born in Bombay, India.
When I was born, it was pretty much obvious that my eyes were smaller than normal. At this point, my family was not sure what was going on. The nurses were not sure what was going on.
Anmol was soon diagnosed with microophthalmia, a disorder in which one or both eyes are abnormally small. He had some vision in his right eye, but was completely blind in the left one. His condition worsened as he got older.
I think like my seventh grade year, I would discover that my vision was actually going down. You know, every year at the end of the year in school, like we always would buy this yearbook, you know, of pictures and everything that happened throughout the year. And that year I bought a yearbook, and normally every other year I could see the pictures clear through. That year I could not. Like, everything was a little bit blurry. When I go to the supermarket, everything was blurry. I discovered that something was happening to my eyes.
At first, Anmol's parents and extended family had trouble accepting his condition. They took him to every specialist they could possibly find in India and abroad. Finally, a specialist in Chennai, then called Madras, India, put all speculation to rest.
That doctor was pretty much straightforward and honest with us. You know, sat us down, he took a really good look at me. He said, you know, there's nothing we can do for your son. Anybody can do. I mean, it is what it is, you know. This is just the part of, you know, it is going to be like this the rest of his life.
Our 10 minutes are over, and Mo's class has started.
Okay. My name is Julie Kaplan, and I am the program coordinator for Money Falls the Person. Do y'all know what Money Falls the Person is? Have y'all kind of been told?
When I heard of CNN, people said Money Falls the Person.
I meet him next morning at his apartment. He is getting ready to leave for his morning workout session at the gym at University of Arkansas's Health, Physical Education, and Recreation Building.
My parents realized pretty soon that one of the problems I'm going to have is getting an education. My parents, they lived in the United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi. In the United Arab Emirates and India, there's very limited education for blind people. The extent of education for blind people has gotten much better now. But just poor, you know, just small schools resulting in making brooms or, maybe just do some wood crafting. Most blind people ended up being beggars on the street there. And my parents didn't want that for myself.
Anmol's parents, who at the time lived and worked in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, enrolled him in a school for the handicapped in Abu Dhabi, and in the meanwhile, looked for educational opportunities abroad. They decided to apply to the Arkansas School of Blind in Little Rock after hearing about it from a family member.
Don't we need to head out?
Yeah, okay.
Sorry about that.
No, you're fine.
It's time for Anmol's workout session.
Is this bus the university's bus?
Yes, the Razorback Paratransit.
I think it might be here.
Yeah, it's coming probably right now, about 8 o'clock.
I meet Anmol later at the University of Arkansas Union for the rest of our conversation. He tells me about his first trip to the United States to join the Arkansas School of Blind in Little Rock as a full-time student. His mother accompanied him on this trip. He was only 10 at the time.
They said my mom stayed with me for 2 months till I could get used to the place. By the time she left, I already had friends and I had a life and a schedule.
But it took him a while to adjust to a totally different culture and his new life.
I mean, of course, I had cultural shocks. One of the first ones that I had was that we eat at 5:30 here. When we went to the cafeteria at 5:30, you know, that's about the time we, in India, that we have milk with a snack. Or if you're grown up, you have tea. We don't eat there till 9 or 10. So at 5:30 I go, I'm thinking, oh, okay, it's probably milk time. Come to find out, it's dinner time. Initially, I was all vegetarian. I did not eat meat at the time. This was a concern to my house parent in the school. So my house parent talked to my mom about it, and she said, you know, make him eat. Whatever is there, he has to eat. He has to learn how to eat meat. His food was going around. He put his beef finger in my plate. He's like, here, eat this. I ate it and I was like, I took one bite. I was like, this is pretty good. That time I never heard of Braille. I never heard of cane. You know, what is, okay, I never gave it thought how, oh, the way I'm going to learn how to read is through Braille. Oh, you know, I learned that, so I was introduced to that within my first day. The first week I was introduced to a Braille teacher. That first week I was also introduced to cane. And so that's how I'm going to be learning how to get around.
After graduating from the Arkansas School of Blind, Anmol completed his undergraduate degree at the Henderson State University in Arkadelphia and got his master's in political science from the Arkansas State University in Jonesboro. He also got a graduate certificate in conflict mediation from the University of Arkansas Little Rock before joining the Rehabilitation Counseling Graduate Program at the University of Arkansas Fayetteville. He says, even though he's always been an international student in the United States, he thinks he's more American than Indian.
Honestly, when I go back to India, I actually feel like I'm more of a foreigner in India than I'm here. I cannot really get used to their culture or their ways. And frankly, I think the way they view disability in India and the way they've, you know, it's not, I'm not really that comfortable. Because I don't think they quite accept people with disabilities there. You know, as independent and fully capable individuals in society.
So is there still something about India that he still feels connected to?
I love Indian food. I miss Indian food. More than anything else I miss is the Indian. But India is Indian food.
Anmol loves politics, debate, surfing the internet, socializing, meeting new people, trying new things, and traveling.
In school, I used to be in track and wrestling, and we would travel to different schools for the blind. We would compete with other schools for the blind across the country. Internationally, I've traveled to 6 countries: India, the United Arab Emirates, of course, Bahrain, Kuwait, the United Kingdom, and the United States. So I haven't traveled that much extensively.
I ask him about what his experience of traveling is like, since for most people, it's about seeing new places.
That's a great question. And I may not get the same experience of scenery, watching the scenes, the beauty of that. One of the things that I think as a blind person I've learned is to imagine things. And just, you know, visualize the picture in my head. What it might have been like. What is it that my friend is, you know, what my friend is describing to me, what something looks like, I can visualize in my head. Oh, okay, maybe this is how it must be looking like this.
Anmol tells me that he is a very adventurous person, so I ask him, what is the most adventurous thing he's done?
I think last year we did climb Mount Perigeen Mountain, Perigeen Mountain. I've done that. The most adventurous thing I've done is fly a plane. I've actually flown a plane. Not totally, but I did have control. And of course, I've also driven a car. You know, a friend of mine, in fact, one time he invited me to his home on a weekend and to his farm and took me to a cow pasture. He's like, okay, now, yeah, you know, he got me behind the wheel and said, start driving. He's like, when I tell you to turn, turn. When I tell you to brake, brake.
He also plans to learn skiing very soon. As for Anmol's future plans, they are ambitious but simple.
My goal in life is to do good in some way or another. Whatever I do is to do good. I want to help people with disabilities. I want to be an advocate for students for people with disabilities. I want to help them, you know, to live a life that is fulfilling. As part of having the disabilities.
And where does he want to live?
I want to live my life in the United States. Been here for 23 years, and I said feel comfortable. Feel like I'm an American. And I just can't imagine living anywhere else.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkan Songs.
Unlike most states, the state of Arkansas is known for a variety of different musical styles, blues, gospel, and folk, to name a few. One genre in which the state has yet to make a mark is in the area of progressive rock. It's a sound often dominated by complex time signatures, virtuosic playing, and artsy, even classical shadings. However, Arkansas had a good contender with the band Rayburn. The Little Rock Quartet was formed in 1970, when the style was popular, but had yet to reach its commercial zenith. The story of Rayburn is near Shakespearean in scope, and it includes a final act of redemption, with all the band's sessions and probably being released decades later by a label owner and music fan who generally releases older psychedelic music. That'd be Harold Ott of Jacksonville and Pulaski County and his record label, Psych of the South. Here's Ott.
It was a really kind of complex, hard rock style that I haven't heard much in my research into Arkansas music. There is kind of a carryover from late psychedelic music to this early, more complex rock that I thought was fascinating in Rayburn.
Said the trail is gone, and it'll never, never, never be the same. There'll be no need for old cowboy songs out on the plain.
Rayburn was formed by keyboardist Steve Stevens. Mac Price joined on bass. He'd been a member of the Retreat Singers, which was formed by teenagers from Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Little Rock and had toured Canada and the UK singing Christian folk music. Robbie Carter replaced original drummer Steve Courtney, with whom they'd written several songs, and Jimmy Roberts played guitar and piano.
They've got kind of a sad theme to a lot of the songs, and a lot of that comes from Jimmy Roberts. Now, Jimmy was a really talented musician. He played sax, he played drums, sang guitar, bass. He was kind of seen as a prodigy on piano. The tragic thing about Jimmy is he got cancer when he was 21 years old and died. This is his musical legacy. This was his last group.
It's all.
Another member of Rayburn was Steve Stevens. He is from the Stevens family of Stevens, Inc. In Little Rock. Jack Stevens was his father, the co-founder of Stevens, Inc. Stevens' father never really approved of his music. Mega Records was a subsidiary of RCA. Through a friend of his father, they got set up at the studio. Mega Records loved them, signed them on the spot. They actually have a recording contract. Well, once Steve gets back and tells his father what's happened, his father basically goes behind his back and buys out the recording contract from RCA and doesn't tell him for about 10 years.
Did you ever
So the band continues on, you know, but they're completely stunned that this recording contract they just signed, they can't get the label to even return their calls.
Getting the hint that the RCA deal was over, though not knowing why, Rayburn went back into the studio. The band recorded at Little Rock's Jagger Studios, cutting song demos for Steve Cropper's TMI label in Memphis, Tennessee. Cropper liked the demos and had Rayburn come to Memphis to record, but TMI ultimately passed on the band. Soon after, in late 1973, Jimmy Roberts was diagnosed with cancer. He died the following summer at age 21. In 1977, the remaining Rayburn band members, plus childhood friend and former bandmate Steve Birchfield, reunited at Jagger Studios in Little Rock to record some vintage and new Rayburn material. It was both a tribute to Roberts and a swan song for the band Rayburn. After experiencing more ups and downs than any rock band should expect, Rayburn had a positive final outcome. The band's tapes finally were released in 2009, decades after their original recording.
There's basically three parts of the CD, the Jaggers recording, the TMI recording, and then later on they go back to Jaggers to record in 1977 some of the songs that they did back then.
Here in its entirety is The Trail Is Gone from 1973 by Little Rock band Rayburn, released in 2009 by Harold Ott
of Jacksonville and Pulaski County on his Psych of the South label.
Said the trail is gone, and it'll never, never, never be the same. There'll be no need for old cowboy songs out on the plains. They're dying out day by day, progression's way. Said the trail is gone, said it's gone. It was covered up years ago. They'll move the earth with their machines, televised the show. It can't be long, it's so discreet, they won't be beat.
Rayburn, a little rock band, with The Trail Is Gone from 1973 and released in 2009 by Harold Ott of Jacksonville and Pulaski County on his Psych of the South label. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information or to subscribe to the podcast, visit arkansongs.org.
We are nearing the end of the year, which means new calendars will be hitting the shelves, including one from Arkansas photographer Tim Ernst.
Sometimes when I'm out taking a picture, I know immediately when I press the shutter, this is going to be a calendar shot. A lot of others, I just, in early May, I sit down and literally go through hundreds of thousands of images, some of them most recent, some of them, you know, years ago that I've never used for anything. And I just all of a sudden one pops and say, oh, yeah, I've got to use that somewhere.
We'll have more tomorrow at noon on Ozarks at Large.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 14th of November, 2011. It's the birthday of the artist who said, I would like to paint the way a bird sings. Claude Monet, born in Paris, 1840. His father ran a grocery store, hoped his son would take over for him, but the son decided to become an artist, much to his father's dismay. Began his studies at the age of 10. He worked first in charcoal, drawing caricatures, which he would sell on the streets. Learned oil painting from an artist named Eugène Boudin, who encouraged him to paint outdoors, to learn to draw well and appreciate the sea, the light, the blue sky. At art school, he met Pierre-Auguste Renoir and Alfred Sisley, artists who rebelled against the fashionable academic painting of the day with its meticulous detail. And they experimented with a new style of landscape painting, producing rapid sketches, using short, broken brush strokes, trying to capture the fleeting quality of the light. A critic referred to them as impressionists. He meant it as an insult, and they adopted it as their label. Monet painted scenes from everyday middle-class life and got good reviews for his painting The Woman in the Green Dress, 1866. His model, Camille Dansieux, became his lover and later his wife. She died of tuberculosis, 1879. Monet painted a portrait of her on her deathbed and moved to a small farmhouse surrounded by an orchard in Giverny, bought a strip of marshland across the road from the house, designed a water garden, spent nearly 30 years in his gardens planting and painting irises and tulips, wisteria and bamboo. His home and gardens in Giverny are now the property of the French Academy of Fine Arts, and you can go see them. And it's the birthday of the satirist P.J. O'Rourke, born Toledo, 1947, the man who said, "There is only one basic human right, the right to do as you damn well please. And with it comes the only basic human duty, the duty to take the consequences." P.J. O'Rourke, who said, "No drug, not even alcohol, causes the fundamental ills of society. If we're looking for the source of our troubles, we shouldn't test people for drugs. We should test them for stupidity, ignorance, greed, and love of power." Here's a poem for today by Tamara Madison, entitled "The Return of the Subjunctive." Oh, the subjunctive, may it make its bold return, may it ride back proud in liveried coach, may its two fine horses snort and paw the ground, and escorted by its staunch attendants, if and whether, may it descend in velvet cloak and black-gloved hand the lacquered steps of hope and happenstance. May it fix upon us its deep, uncertain gaze. I shall be there to greet it, though my company be small and moody. I shall beg it stay, and may its presence give some respite from the steely glare of indicative, a mantle to shield us from passive's clammy chill. May it light again the land between the world that was and is, and that which still might be, and may we tread again desire's leaf-dappled path of possibility." The Return of the Subjunctive, a poem by Tamara Madison, from her collection Wild Domestic, published by Pearl Editions, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, combining the power of email marketing and social media for more customers and more time back on your clock. ConstantContact.com. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, committed to diabetes care and areas of unmet medical needs at novonordisk-us.com. Produced by Kathy Roach and written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
KUAF is supported by Ella's Restaurant, located at the Inn at Carnell Hall on the University of Arkansas campus. Ella's offers a variety of fine dining experiences during breakfast, lunch, dinner, and weekend brunch. An Indian lunch buffet is served each Tuesday. Menus, event schedules, and more available at ellasrestaurant.com. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, MENA. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Have a great day.